This is the fifth day of this July 2009 7-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text titled Zen Essence, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. It's a collection of miscellaneous teachings by miscellaneous Chinese masters from the 8th century on. This is Zen Master Yang Qi. Someone asked Yang Qi, "It is said, if you want to escape from clamor in the mind, you should read the ancient teaching. What is the ancient teaching?" This is not a beginner. This is someone who wants to get something going, and he poses this challenge. What is the ancient teaching? Yang Qi replied, "The moon is bright in space. The waves are calm on the ocean." The inquirer asked, "How does one read it?" Yang Qi said, "Watch your step." What's the connection between Yang Qi's first reply, "The moon is bright in space, the waves are calm on the ocean," and then his saying, "Watch your step"? At the risk of sounding like a broken record, we have to be on the alert not to allow ourselves to sink into a passive, dead sitting where we just relish the quiet. It's even more of a danger out here in the country than it was when we used to have sesshin in the city, because everything is conspiring, in a sense, to lure us into this quietude and this potentially dead calm. It would be such a diminished spiritual tradition if we settled for just calmness. The great Sufi master Rumi once said, "Wherever you find a lullaby, leave. Safety is final danger." Well, it's not so easy to correct oneself when one is sinking into this dead quietude, and that's where the monitors and the teacher have to step forward and do what's called for to help people from sinking into that quicksand of calm. But what the sitter can do and must do is never to be aware of any resting in that calmness, and to keep the work, the attention, keep it vigorous and active and dynamic, keep the practice dynamic and not let it sink into mere tranquility. This just means attention, just keeping one's attention as aroused as possible, and moment by moment, millisecond by millisecond, noticing, watching the mind, watching for when the mind drifts, and keeping it lively. He also said, I am asked to expound the supreme vehicle of Zen, but if it is the supreme vehicle, even the sages stand aside. Buddhas and Zen masters disappear. Why? Because you are all the same as the Buddhas of old. If it is the supreme vehicle, even the sages and the Buddhas and masters disappear. They have no place in the teaching in its fundamental purity. There is no other. You are all the same as the Buddhas of old. He goes on, but can you really believe and trust this? If you really can, let us all disband and go our separate ways. If you don't leave, I'll go on fooling you. What does he mean, fooling? It's a feeling that any teacher of understanding has sometimes, that all of this is, as Harada Roshi said, selling water by the river, raising waves where there is no wind. Everyone is fully enlightened from the very beginning. Nowhere to go, nothing to attain. What are we all doing here? Well, we're here because we need to be here. Because our understanding is less than perfect. There's a famous saying in Zen, even Shakyamuni is only halfway there. And Dogen says it a little more artfully. If you've gone all the way, keep going. You only get it when you're halfway. If anyone were to think that she or he had arrived in some final attainment, it would be only deceiving themselves. Another time he said, mind is the faculty, phenomena are the data. Both are like scratches in a mirror. So we could also use other words for this, subject and object. Subject is the faculty, object are the data, both are like scratches in a mirror. When there are no scratches or dust, the clarity of the mirror shows. When mind and phenomena are both forgotten, then your nature is real. Four things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. The two are merely relative. We use these designations, we use these dichotomies, subject, object, mind and phenomena. But they're just that, ultimately, just designations. There's another challenger who came to Yangqi and said, when the founder of Zen came from India to China, he sat facing a wall for 9 years. What does this mean? Yangqi said, as an Indian, he couldn't speak Chinese. We're going to talk about meaning. That's as good as any other description of it. Here's a Zen master, Wu Zhu. Wu Zhu Fayan. His Japanese name is Goso. Let's see if we have anything on him. He had already reached middle age when he entered Zen specialization. That would mean that most of these masters, they didn't start out practicing Zen. They started off most commonly getting a basis in the precepts by mastering the precepts and the monastic rules and regulations and the Vinaya school, and then moved on to Zen later and make that their focus. He had already reached middle age when he began practicing Zen. Says here, one of the great Zen prodigies of the time, Bai Yun, a direct heir of Yangqi, who became a Zen teacher at an unusually young age and passed away early. Bai Yun sent Wu Zhu to run the mill operated by the Zen monastery in a town below the mountain on which the monastery was located. It is said that whenever monks would come down the mountain snooping around, Wu Zhu would scandalize them by flirting with the young women who came to the mill. These big monasteries in China were like great plantations of a sort. They were so self-sufficient. They the vast farmlands and mills, obviously. Even the biggest ones had hospitals and clinics and orphanages. Wu Zhu was later known for a skill in teaching that was unique in his time, using graphic stories, colorful metaphors, earthy poetry, profound abstractions, paradoxical actions, and forthright statements to open the minds of his hearers. So here are some of his words. When there is not a speck of cloud dotting the great clarity for 10,000 miles, sun and moon in the original sky are of themselves clear. It is not permitted for a general to see great peace, but a general may establish great peace. This is a very important distinction. Roshi Kaplow used to say, Kensho, an initial opening, Kensho does not transform one's life, but it establishes the basis for transforming one's life. There's too much clearing that still has to occur. The forces of habit patterns are just still too strong to to be at complete peace when one has a first breakthrough. That just initiates one into the work that has to go on. It establishes the basis for transforming our life, because it's when we have seen the unreality of self and other that we can make the best progress and avoid fooling ourselves as much. The habit forces are still there, but we no longer can be deceived about them. They're really right in our faces, painfully obvious. So there is the experience, and then there is the full realization, the making it real. That's what realization means, making it real. Meaning having it inform one's daily life, all of one's interactions with people in stressful conditions. This is the work of a lifetime. So he says, it's not permitted for a general to see great peace, to see the land come under general peace, but a general may establish great peace, defeat the enemy, if you will, to see that there never was an enemy. Another time he said, to practice Zen, first you must obtain directions to the ultimate goal. Hearing sound and seeing form are inconceivable. From the eternal sky, every night, the moon shines on every home. Its reflection descends into a quiet pool, but how many know? This statement, hearing sound and seeing form are inconceivable. What does he mean by this? Because the pure act of sensing, hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and so forth, have nothing to do with conceptualization. They stand on their own. They are immediate, direct. When he says, but how many know? It's because we complicate this pure apprehension of reality, the direct experience of things, with these obscurations of thought. From the eternal sky, every night the moon shines on every home. And most people are asleep. Another time he said, there is a road to emptiness by which everyone can arrive. Those who do arrive realize that its rich flavor is lasting. The ground of mind doesn't produce useless plants. Naturally, the body radiates light. Every body. in one very short statement, he said, talking about Zen all the time is like looking for fish tracks in a dry riverbed. Which goes back to the feeling a teacher can get of fooling people. Next one is one of the most famous of the Chinese masters, Yuan Wu, who is the other editor of the Blue Cliff Record, sometimes considered the author of the Blue Cliff Record. He was the one I mentioned yesterday who, 60 years after Shui Do first gathered together these dialogues and stories, then added his own material and it became known as the Blue Cliff Record. He said, human lives go along with circumstances. It is not necessary to reject activity and seek quiet. Just make yourself inwardly empty while outwardly harmonious. Then you will be at peace in the midst of frenetic activity in the world. It's a very, very articulate way of summing it up. Just make yourself inwardly empty, so detached from thought, while outwardly harmonious. They go together. The so-called inward emptiness gives us the freedom and adaptability to accommodate ourselves to others in the world, to harmonize with others. It's our rigid clinging to our notions, our opinions. This is what sets us up for conflict. It's quite a Taoistic flavor to this this little passage. It's a lot of Taoism in Zen. This great emphasis on harmonizing with the so-called world, with others, with our circumstances, becoming like clouds and water. The Japanese word for a novice monk is just that, clouds and water, because these are seen as the something to aspire to, the egolessness of clouds and water and the way that they just effortlessly flow and adapt to circumstances, not setting themselves up in opposition to others. Well, that's easier talked about than realized. When others are themselves oppositional, what do you do? Well, this again is the work of a lifetime. Another way to sum it all up is it comes down to skillful means. That the particular means or responses in any situation will very much depend on that particular situation, who it is we're dealing with, and the whole context and everything about it. This is why we can't set up any hard and fast rules. The one great asset we would have then is to realize this truth of no self. And then there would be different responses called for at different times, different situations, including standing firm at times, not yielding. And other times, yielding. I suppose that most people realize eventually in marriage that it's so much about knowing when to yield, when to, well, to pick your battles. My wife has counseled so many people. Mostly individually, sometimes together, but usually individually, and she often finds herself saying to them, "What is more important to you? What is more important to you, to be right or to have a relationship?" This unyielding insistence on being right, deciding who's right and who's wrong. This is a disaster in marriage. What does it all come down to, right and wrong? We're just working together. Like, just as a teacher and student are working together. Just finding our way. Like clouds and water. Here's a very short one, still Yuan Wu. Over the course of centuries, Zen has branched out into different schools with individual methods, but the purpose is still the same, to point directly to the human mind. Once the ground of mind is clarified, there is no obstruction at all. You shed views and interpretations that are based on concepts such as victory and defeat, self and other, right and wrong. Thus you pass through all that and reach a realm of great rest and tranquility. The purpose is still the same, to point directly to the human mind. It means to reveal the nature of mind. And what is that nature? Well, in words, it is without any substance. It's empty. It is just a process of mental formations that come form and then dissolve and reform and then come apart again. We all see this in our Zazen. Just look, it's right there. Thoughts arise, feelings arise, they last a shorter or longer period of time, and then they disappear. Flux. Where is there a mind that you can put your finger on? Say, this is it. Things are things because of mind, and mind is mind because of things. It's an artificial notion, mind. Where does mind end and things begin? How can you possibly distinguish between mind and phenomena? Mind itself is just phenomena in flux. And physical phenomena couldn't be apprehended except through mind. You can't, it's an abstraction to imagine phenomena apart from mind, even physical phenomena. Here's another selection. What is most difficult to rectify is half-baked Zen, where you stick to quiet stillness and consider this the ultimate treasure, keeping it in your heart, radiantly aware of it all the time, carrying around a bunch of mixed-up knowledge and understanding, claiming to have vision and to have attained the approval of a Zen master, just increasing your egoism. I gather from these texts that I've read that there's a lot more of kind of unabashed arrogance in the time of in ancient China and even Japan than there is now that I'm aware of, where people just without shame would just swagger around and boast about having seen this or this or that. We've been spared that more or less, mostly, for now. This ailment, he says, where you stick to quiet stillness and consider this the ultimate treasure. There's a related phenomenon, which is being attached to a certain mode of moving about, like walking slowly. There's no need to walk slowly to be concentrated. It's a false equivalence. You can be wonderfully concentrated, moving swiftly. In fact, you could even make the case that in moving quickly, you're less liable to be stuck in your thoughts. Sometimes I suggest to people, I say, notice that you move awfully deliberately and ponderously all the time, not just sometime, but habitually, moving very slowly and ploddingly. And I suggest try moving faster sometimes, because just as our mind affects our movement, our body, let's say, generally, mind affects body, so also body affects mind. If our mind is clogged with thoughts, we're more likely to move slowly and hesitatingly. So if we move a little faster, we learn to take a chance and move a little faster, then we might find that we're not getting caught in thoughts as much. Always, body and mind are just two aspects of one living thing. It's the same, of course, when sitting still, when we're doing actual sitting. If we're sitting upright, and if we get ourselves arranged properly and get this pelvic tilt, establish a strong, stable base, pull the spine upright. Well, our mind, our sitting, will reflect that posture, that uprightness and strength. and at the same time relaxation with the relaxed shoulders. So this is something that is surprisingly absent from most traditions, this apparent minimization of the importance of posture. It's hugely important to the condition of our mind, how we sit, not just sit, how we stand, how we walk, how we move, how we lie down. People who habitually move slowly are likely to have issues with control and imagining that they don't, they're trying to hold on. Oh, I gotta be careful. Hold on to this. Don't let any thoughts come in. With work too, if you see this, people, so sometimes during work period where people are raking very slowly. Try moving faster, rake faster, do things briskly, and you might be surprised at what a liberating effect this has on the mind. Here's another one. In those who attain Zen, mental machinations disappear, vision and action are forgotten, and there are no subjective views. Vision and action are forgotten. We could say that we're seeing purely, without any notion of self and other, or with action that there's unselfconscious action. It's moving without moving, in a way. Zen practitioners just remain free and are imperceptible to anyone, either would-be supporters or would-be antagonists. They walk in the bottom of the deepest ocean, uncontaminated, with free minds, acting normally, indistinguishable from the average person. That's something that beginners would strike beginners as hard to understand. You know, he's supposed to, and beginners, and the way their thinking goes, if you're really advanced in your practice, you're enlightened, then you have some special quality of some aura, charisma, some glow. This is not what the deepest understanding reveals, according to the great masters like him, like Yuan Mu, indistinguishable from the average person. One of our spiritual, uncles, Yamada Roshi, who's in one of the enlightenment accounts in the Three Pillars of Zen, he has said, nothing distinguishes the enlightened person. This is also, I think, something quite distinct about the Zen tradition, that is a kind of invisibility that is the mark of someone very developed. Nothing special. It's a utter unselfconsciousness and transparency. There's this famous story of the great Zen master of considerable enlightenment who would sit up in the mountains, sit in his hut, and birds would come and were drawn to him, And then he had one final great enlightenment experience, and the birds stopped coming. Nobody left. An empty hut. He just to finish up here, he says, though they liberate their minds directly and develop to this state, they are still unwilling to dwell here. They sense the slightest thing as mountainous. Anything that seems to cause obstruction, they immediately push away. Well, this is admiring. This is that when the mind becomes, the more pure and empty the mind becomes, the more acutely we become aware of the remaining thoughts. This can be confusing to people late in sesshin. When we feel that we've really gotten somewhere, the mind is concentrated and feeling really borne along by the samadhi power, and then we notice these thoughts that seem so formidable, so strong, but it can't be. After sitting 5, 6, 7 days, it's just that the remaining traces of thoughts are so conspicuous by contrast of the emptiness of the mind. They jump out at us. I always tell this to people who suddenly feel discouraged that there are still these strong thoughts in the mind. They're just in the foreground. They're just conspicuous. There's very little behind them. The slightest thing, they sense the slightest thing as mountainous, he says. Again, it's all about noticing those little thoughts that ordinarily we wouldn't even see. Most people don't have a clue about the noise in the mind. But when things start to get quiet, then we notice it. That's good, because we notice it, then we go on from there and keep working and never fall into any sense of complacent attainment or having arrived. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.